Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 09-2028, State of Ohio versus Roland Davis. Mr. Hardwick.
May it please the court, Mr. Oswald. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honor, I'm going to start with the issue that this court directed us to brief, and that's the text of the constitutional amendment from 1994, because it's simple and should be easy to resolve. The text of that amendment states that courts of appeals only lost jurisdiction to, quote, review on direct appeal a judgment that imposes a sentence of death. And whatever you can say about a judgment that denies leave to file a new trial motion, it does not impose a sentence of death. That should resolve the issue. The system has worked for the last 15 years. Both sides have gotten used to it. And most importantly, it's the system that the text of our Constitution commands. And unless there are any questions on that, I'd like to address I'll move on to the special prosecutor's issue. Criminal Rule 33 gives trial courts the power and responsibility to rule on new trial motions in the first instance. And trial courts lack jurisdiction only to defy the specific mandate of a higher court on a specific issue. And I think the basic mistake of some of the lower courts and of the state is that it treats a judgment of affirmance by an appellate court as some sort of general stamp of approval on everything that happened or even could have happened in a trial court, when in fact that's not the case. When a higher court reviews a decision of a lower court, it's not saying that every decision the trial court made was proper. It's saying these five assignments of error are not valid. That is it. I can see some of the language in special prosecutors, a few sentences here, they're taken out of context, could lead to the conclusion that some courts of appeals and trial court and the state has taken it. But when read in context, there is a significant amount of narrowing language in special prosecutors itself that demonstrates that case was about a trial court that was defying a higher court's ruling on the same subject based on the same evidence that was before it. And this court, when it defined the issue that the state was presenting, said that the state was arguing that, quote, the court of appeals decision on the voluntariness of the plea became law of the case and the trial court was bound to follow it. It wasn't that the general affirmance meant everything the trial court did was right, just that that specific issue on law of the case on the voluntariness of the plea could not be relitigated in the trial court. Further, the court then defined the question narrowly as whether Criminal Rule 32.1 allows the trial court to grant a motion to withdraw the plea after an appeal has been taken relative to that plea. And then the court added that when the appellate court has affirmed the trial court's judgment resulting from that plea of guilty. The court went on to say the trial court's granting of the new trial motion to withdraw the plea was inconsistent with the judgment of the Court of Appeals that it affirmed the trial court judgment premised upon the guilty plea. And finally, critically, the court said the judgment of a reviewing court is controlling upon the lower courts as to all matters within the compass of the judgment. Within the compass of the judgment, not as to all matters that could have been within the compass of the judgment, all matters that actually were within the compass of the judgment. And this court, in State Actual Marshall v. Cordray, expressly rejected the argument that the state is making today. This court, in distinguishing another case that it had decided, the Bolt-Meredith case, this court held that the law of the case doctrine does not apply to a, quote, trial court order granting relief to a defendant on grounds not resolved on the previous appeal. Not resolved on the previous appeal. That's what this court held in State Actual Cordray v. Marshall. Now, the state's view is not only at odds with more recent explanations of special prosecutors, it's at odds with what Criminal Rule 33 tries to do, which is give trial courts the power and the duty to decide these motions in the first place. It vests with trial courts the power to screen and the duty to screen these motions. And it has, and it even tells the trial courts the criteria. If you're bringing a repetitive claim, you can't win because you have to show to even file after 120 days that you are unavoidably prevented from filing earlier. That's a decision this court, when it enacted Crim Rule 33, that's a decision this court gave to trial courts, not to appellate courts. And by contrast, the state's position that we have to go to the Court of Appeals first is supported by no rule, no statute, and no case law. They have no rule, no statute, and no case law to support their position. And unless there's any other questions, I can reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Oswald?
Good morning, Your Honors. On behalf of the Licking County Prosecutor's Office and the State of Ohio, I'm here to represent the state's position in this case. I was a trial counsel in this case, and I've handled all the appeals associated with this case since Mr. Davis was convicted about 6 years ago, within a matter of a week or so. In this particular case, I'm going to start with the same issue that my opposing counsel started with, and I don't think that issue has an easiest answer as they would like, and that is whether or not in cases where the death penalty is imposed, should those appeals come to this court directly. I know for the last 15, 16, depending on how you count it, years, the practice of this state is all these, what I refer to in my brief as second-tier appeals, have been going through the Court of Appeals. Okay? This is actually an issue I debated raising, but I, as I will point out, there are some risks by winning this issue without also accepting my invitation to make this ruling prospective in nature. So I want to emphasize on this issue, if I win the day in convincing you that all these appeals need to come to this court, I want to also win the second issue, that is, this ruling is prospective in nature, because if you don't do that, one thing I agree, where this side of the courtroom is, you will create one heck of a mess. But in this particular case...
Isn't that a jurisdictional issue, though? A constitutional jurisdictional issue, and if we find that there's all these appeals should have come directly here and the Court of Appeals has no jurisdiction, how can we make that prospective only?
Good question, and here's the answer. If you look at this issue, and you look at the real issue is, okay, if a defendant has suffered some kind of right, the issue here is what appellate tribunal should hear his complaints? That's what we're dealing with here. If you look at the cases that apply prospective application, you're looking at cases that go to the very heart of the truth-finding process, the very heart of whether a person has been denied the right to counsel, the right to proper Miranda warnings, the right to evidentiary rulings, whether it's confrontation or the like. And in those cases, the United States Supreme Court, this court, has held that many of those, Griffin v. Kentucky being one of them, can be held prospectively only. And it seems to me, if we're talking about a new rule that goes to the very heart of whether a person should have been found guilty in the first place, those are the ones that least likely should be made only prospective. When we're talking about the issue here is, okay, what court hears his complaints? That's hardly, it seems to me, is something in the weighing process that automatically ought to be retrospective, okay?
Well, and as I question, it's a question of whether the court has the authority or power to hear the case, not whether it's a new right that's recognized. It just goes to the heart of the authority to decide. Is it not?
I know of no case anywhere, and I've not found any, that makes a distinction in terms of being able to make retroactive versus prospective ruling the issue of whether it's a jurisdictional claim or not. And I can think of no rational basis for doing so. Don't get me wrong, I understand the general notion that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised any time, but unless and until the court says, no, this ruling is prospective. The Supreme Court of the United States has told us in the cases I cite that states have a lot of latitude in deciding when their new ruling should be prospective in nature. And in this particular case, I can't think of a better case for saying this is prospective. I honestly can't, in all candor with the court, because you will create a heck of a mess in 17 years of death penalty litigation appeals by putting every one of those Court of Appeals actions subject to challenge. And I don't think it's worth it. But at the same time, I don't think it's worth this court, and no offense to the court, because everybody's done this, that we continue after 15 years ignoring what I think clearly was the intent of the voters in enacting those amendments. Now, you can look at those amendments and talk about the phrase direct appeal, and we as attorneys and judges can talk all we want about that has a legal terminology, a legal meaning. But come on, do you really think the electorate knew anything other than, okay, it's going directly to the Supreme Court? All these death penalty cases are going to the directly to the Supreme Court. With respect to that, what's particularly important is, as I cite in my brief, the explanation for issue one when it was put on the ballot. And this is just part of the explanation. If adopted, the amendment will eliminate the review of death penalty cases by the District Court of Appeals and provide that these cases be reviewed directly by the Ohio Supreme Court. There is no caveat, except in second-tier appeals. There is no caveat that district
courts... But if you tie that back to the language, it says direct appeals, and that language could only still be referring to the first direct appeal.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because we're talking about what the electorate understood. And in the Hupp case, the Rhodes case, we don't put technical legal meanings on constitutional amendments that were passed by the electorate. We put common, plain understanding meanings to those terms.
Do you and think I, that the public understood that post-conviction relief motions would come directly here or type like that?
I think the electorate would have had to have believed, I honestly believe this, that, geez, that means all appeals will go to the Supreme Court.
Well,
yes,
are we governed by what the electorate believed or what the language of the Constitution says?
Well, both, actually, in the sense that the constitutional amendment talks about cases in which the death penalty has been imposed. This is a case, this is an appeal in a case in which the death penalty is imposed,
it's
number
direct
one.
Direct appeal.
What's the definition of a direct appeal?
I'm going to answer that in this way. A definition of a direct appeal, generally speaking, is an appeal predicated upon the evidence as it existed at the time of sentence. That's my view of what a direct appeal is. Okay. Anything after that, anything that supplements the record, in legal terms, shouldn't be a direct appeal. But we're not talking about applying that legal terminology to what the voters thought. We're trying to ascertain what the voters thought when they said.
But do you have any authority as to what the voters thought?
Well, I don't know how you can take a poll, obviously.
Exactly. That's my point. What's the underpinnings to your statement that this is what the voters thought?
The explanation for issue one that's provided to the voters that says, if adopted, the amendment will eliminate the review of death penalty cases by the District Court of Appeals. This was provided to voters. Now, I have no way of knowing how many have read them, but I can't imagine that that the general electorate understood the terminology direct appeal in the manner that we as attorneys use that. I think what they understood is they will go directly to the Supreme Court. That's the terminology, the meaning I think electors put on it, okay? But in any event, if the court were to accept that all these cases should come here, I absolutely am sincere in asking the court to make that ruling prospective in nature. It will be a mess. So as I point out in my brief, I want to win on that issue as well as the other one or neither one. I'm not here to create a bigger mess for judges around the state by imposing upon them the ability or the need to go back and revisit 17 years of capital litigation. Let me talk about the special prosecutor's matter now.
Okay? Mr. Oswald, before you do that, what is being asked here by the appellant, the idea that there is newly discovered evidence warranting a new trial, the nature of what is being requested normally is heard by a trial court, isn't it? I mean, the idea of looking at the evidence, determining at a hearing, let's say, what the issues are, that's typically something that's done in a trial court venue, is it not?
It is typically done in that case. You're absolutely correct. And as a matter of fact, in special prosecutors, that's what was done. And what did this court say? Don't do that. Not on this fact pattern, you can't do that. My point is, and what's being missed here is, I'm not saying that legitimate motions for new trial can never be filed after an appeal. What I'm saying, the rule ought to be, and the rule coming out of special prosecutors is, absent a remand, the trial court can't touch something after the appellate court has affirmed.
So what you're saying in these death penalty cases, if there is newly discovered evidence that may really strike at the heart of the conviction, that you would be saying that there would be no vehicle for a defendant to present that motion?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
And You're saying that it should come to the appellate court,
to determine that? Well, first of all, I want to point out that this special prosecutor's issue, unlike the second issue that the court asked us to brief, is not necessarily limited to death penalty cases. So let's make that clear. Okay.
We're talking about a death penalty case, which Correct. Is, we've what, always said death is different.
What I'm saying is, what ought to be done is if a court, Supreme Court in this case, has affirmed that conviction, and as we know from Baker, a conviction is the sentence and the finding of guilt. So if a trial court does anything to remove either, they've removed the very foundation of what the first court ruled upon.
But not
what
if
I'm
the first court did not have the evidence that has been developed, discovered, established, you know, if that's not before this court.
I agree. That's why I suggest this, because this rule, this lives with the spirit of special prosecutors, the sanctity of the superior court being the gatekeeper function. That's this. If Mr. Davis, his attorneys have a legitimate claim, they come to the last, in this case, this court, highest appellate court that's entertained jurisdiction on the case, and ask for a limited remand, saying, Your Honors, we have a meritorious claim, and we want you to remand this matter to the trial court to take evidence to see if it really is. That's all I'm asking.
By rule or statute?
That's by the special prosecutor that case that says absent a remand. That's what's missed when we look at special prosecutors. Absent a remand. What I'm suggesting they need to do is they go to the Supreme Court, present their material, and say, we want a motion for new trial.
If there were a DNA sample discovered, which the defendant said, this may prove that I wasn't really the perpetrator or the shooter, before that goes in as newly discovered evidence for a trial court to consider, they must present it here to the Supreme Court and ask, based on the newly discovered DNA evidence, this case be remanded back to the trial court. That's what you think we have to do.
That's right. Here's why. Here's what's going on in this case. This defendant was convicted in 2005. They were appointed a defense DNA expert. He didn't testify, but they were appointed it. Two states experts, one from the Columbus Crime Lab, one from a forensic lab out of North Carolina, indicated that the defendant's DNA, in one case, 547 million to one, and the other one, 97.1 quadrillion to one, was Roland Davis's DNA. In the middle of trial, they threw out the prospect of Randy Davis, who was at that time a deceased brother of the defendant, but at the time of the crime, obviously was alive, and suggested and argued that, well, what can it be Randy's, okay? Both experts testified unless it's an identical sibling, and he wasn't, there's a birth certificate to prove Roland Davis was a single birth, we can exclude Randy Davis because of the statistics here, okay? It goes to this court, and they challenge the DNA in front of this court. They file a post-conviction petition putting on it a challenge to the DNA, making essentially the same arguments they then later make, just using a different person to do it, about the DNA. It's denied, the post-conviction, it goes to the Court of Appeals. We'll talk about whether that's right or wrong because of the issue you've asked us to brief, but it nonetheless goes to the Court of Appeals, and they reject it, okay? Here comes the motion for new trial. 2008. They've got a Dr. Mueller out of the, I believe, the West Coast to now give an affidavit, which if you look at it, looks like the same affidavit, just a different signature than Mr. Meyer's affidavit in the post-conviction petition. In this particular case, the lower court rejects the stuff without touching the jurisdictional issues. The Court of Appeals accepts the jurisdictional claim. In this particular case, my argument is, you know, even if you take a narrow reading of special prosecutors, this is the same issue.
Well, let's change the scenario a little bit.
Okay.
We have a trial. Let's say it's not even a death penalty, because you say this proposition applies to all cases. You have a trial, goes to Court of Appeals, comes to us on one narrow issue, speedy trial. And so the only thing we look at is, did this guy get the speedy trial or not? Now they come back with newly discovered evidence. Under your proposition, that motion for newly discovered evidence, which has nothing to do with speedy trial, comes to us. We've never seen the rest of the record. It wasn't germane to our issue. That's going to require us to go through this entire record from a trial perspective and see if that's valid.
Then you need to rewrite special prosecutors, because in special prosecutors, the defendant was convicted by plea. He filed a direct appeal. That direct appeal was resolved in March of 1976. In September of 1976, he filed a motion to withdraw the plea. It sat for a while for reasons that aren't real clear, but I attached some of the materials from that old case that was from your court file. Your clerk was nice enough to find this for me. But anyway, that motion is, a hearing is held in September of 1976. During that hearing, Mr. Asher, who was a defendant in that case, put his former defense attorney on the stand to testify that he pled guilty because the prosecutor and the judge had threatened to give him worse punishment, whatever, okay? That came to this court. And my point is, the argument that came to this court was it was a different issue. Different evidence that the first Court of Appeals did not have, which he couldn't have. The first appeal was resolved in March of 1976. This hearing didn't take place until September of 1976, and the judge didn't rule on it until February of 1977. So by the time it got to this court on a prohibition claim, there was additional testimony. There was a different issue. But you said, too bad.
Well, maybe we should look at special prosecutor.
Well, perhaps. All I'm saying is, if special prosecutor stands for absent a remand, you can't be upsetting a conviction that's been affirmed by the Court of Appeals. But here's the other problem to this, though. Let's say you narrow that, tailor that down to different issues. We're going to have a case like this. I'm saying this is the same issue. They're going to say it's a different issue. This is DNA. It's the same issue at trial, direct appeal, post-conviction, appellate post-conviction, and now. So what you're going to do is, if you try to, and it sounds great to say it's the same issue or not, but it's hard to do, because then you have arguments like this. This is a different issue. It's a different expert. And I'm saying it's the same issue. It's the same evidence.
You
okay.
Go through
my
process.
Point is,
the trial sorts it out, decides whether it is or it isn't, and it goes up on appeal.
I guess my point is this: isn't the court that had the appeals, whether that's the Court of Appeals in most cases or the Supreme Court, isn't that the best court to decide? Yep, this is the same issue, or no, it's not.
But not without a record developed to allow us to do that. And you're asking us to do it just based on the pleadings, and whatever the supplement to those pleadings are, and that could become problematic. And the next problem you have is you've used your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've reserved about 10 minutes.
I'll try not to use it all. The state, I think, is simply wrong when it says that there was no new issue on the new trial motion. In the post-conviction appeal, the Court of Appeals ruled two things critically to the DNA evidence. First, it said that the innocence claim that Mr. Davis raised could not even be raised in post-conviction. In some ways, they're right. That you only raise constitutional claims on a post-conviction petition, and new trial motions are specifically designed for innocence claims absent constitutional error. Secondly, the Court of Appeals ruled that the attorney affidavit, which was the only supporting documentation, was insufficient to support an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on this ground. That's what the ruling was. It wasn't that the attorneys performed admirably. It was simply that an attorney affidavit is not sufficient to support an ineffective assistance claim. That is not, and they also then held you need an expert to sign an affidavit. Well, that's what was done in the new trial motion. There was, if the issue on post-conviction was, is an attorney affidavit sufficient? That is not the same issue as did you prove it now that you have an expert affidavit. So they are different, distinct issues. As to the remand issue, that's what happens at the end of this case. At the end of every case, the Chief Justice signs an entry that's under this court's Rule 11.4 becomes the mandate of the court and sent to the trial court. That's how the baton gets handed back to the trial court. Same thing on appeals, Appellate Rule 27. When a court of appeals is done with the case, they send it back to the trial court. So the baton is passed routinely in every case. You do not need an extra, what the state would require is to do an extra motion in every case. So it would be completely superfluous. The one thing the state is correct on, I believe, is this court does need to rewrite, to clarify special prosecutors. Not really rewrite it, but to tell the lower courts that what they are doing is not what this court meant. Because what lower courts are doing is just using this case just pops out of nowhere in cases, and all of a sudden they say, well, you had an appeal, therefore we're not going to rule on your case. And we see that time after time, especially in the non-capital cases.
Are motions lingering in trial courts around Ohio?
There are motions like this. I filed a merit brief yesterday on this issue in another court. So I don't know if the lingering is the right word. They're not lingering, but without any seeming reason or rhyme to it, this all of a sudden you see a special prosecutor's motion in a case and the trial court might throw it out or the court of appeals might throw it out.
So what would a rewrite of special prosecutors look like in your world?
It would be the language that this court used in Marshall in paragraph 35, that it does not apply, that it only applies to issues where the trial court is ruling on the same issue based on the same evidence that the Court of Appeals had. If you get new evidence, you raise a different issue, trial court has first crack at it. The state can still raise res judicata. If they think we could have raised it earlier, that's an affirmative defense. We have clear rules to support that.
And then in death penalty cases, where does that go if it goes back, if special prosecutors clarified to that extent, it goes back to the trial court on whatever the allegation is, new evidence, et cetera, where would it go then?
It would just be filed. Whichever side is dissatisfied, you'd file in the trial court. We would file in the trial court. Whichever side is dissatisfied with the trial court files under, going back to the issue this court ordered us to brief, goes to the Court of Appeals.
It goes to the Court of Appeals then?
Correct.
You still have these, quote, second-tier appeals going to the Court of Appeals as opposed to directly to the Supreme Court.
Correct.
And that's where you're at odds with your opponent here.
And I think, yes. And looking even at the text of the ballot initiative, the state quotes the second paragraph of the voter explanation. The first paragraph tells the voters that all appeals currently, as of 1993, 1994, go to the Court of Appeals and to this court. That's what the text says. Well, that wasn't the case. That was clearly talking about only the direct appeal process. It was not talking about the collateral process where the appeal to this court was discretionary. The text of the ballot language was only talking about the direct appeal process. If the state's interpretation of what the ballot text, if the state is correct about what the second paragraph meant, the whatever committee drafted that ballot text was just flat out wrong and was misinforming voters about the current process. And in matters of jurisdiction, you have to use precise language, and at some point, you have to give the voters responsibility for what they are voting yes and no for. And in some ways, if you don't give them that responsibility, you're taking away the power from them to enact the text that is before them. What if a voter wanted to actually enact that text? The state is taking that power away from them because they're saying, no, the ballot text, the ballot board language overrule somehow controls over the text of the constitutional amendment. Your Honor, unless there are any other questions, all we are asking this court to do is to send this case back to the Court of Appeals to make their decision to review the trial court's decision based on an abuse of discretion standard to see if we were unavoidably prevented from filing this earlier. That's a decision the Court of Appeals declined to make. This court should remand the case for them to make that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under consideration, and you will be advised of our opinion. Thank you very much, gentlemen.